Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, how important is harmony in your life? Of course, it's very important. So how important is dissonance in your life? Well, maybe that's important too. Maybe we really can't create what we want in life without something out of the ordinary. And so we're going to talk about jazz, which can be very out of the ordinary and very harmonious at the same time, or almost at the same time. And we're not only going to talk about jazz, but we're going to talk about how it relates to reality and how reality needs harmony, and it also, unfortunately, needs some dissonance. And we're here and living in it. And so we're going to talk about jazz and reality in terms of physics, the world of physics. So I read a wonderful book called The Jazz of Physics, and it relates, it's the secret link between music and the structure of the universe. That's incredible. This was an incredible book. And it was written, the author is a man who's a jazz musician and a theoretical physicist, and his name is Stefan Alexander, and he's a guest on our show to talk about this incredible universe we live in based on improvisation, on jazz improvisation. So, Stefan, welcome to Energy Stew.
Oh, it's great to be here. Wonderful to be here, and thanks for liking my book so much.
Oh, it's incredible. It has so much to offer. I actually, unfortunately, have pages and pages and pages of notes. Too many pages, but that's all right, because I love those notes.
Yes.
There's some background noise, and I wonder if that's in the studio.
It's in the studio, that's right. No, it's in my studio.
Oh, okay. So let's talk about this. This is about how the universe works, and how it needs dissonance. It needs something like an improvisational jazz riff that really makes life work.
That's what the data seems to be asking us to theorize about. Yes.
Yeah. Now, this book covers just about everything in terms of creation. And I love it because it brings out the scientist in me to want to understand it even more. Because as a theoretical physicist, you're really looking at how the universe was formed, what created it, and what makes it work.
Yes.
And so you use jazz as a way to understand it, and you've had so many inspirations from playing jazz and from hearing jazz.
Yes. Yes, the inspiration part was very important, both in the writing of the book and, of course, in terms of the information that I obtained from those musicians and scientists that helped me along my path.
Right, and it's impossible to really define life in ways that aren't theoretical. So
that's right.
You have all these, thousands and thousands of equations and formulations, and still there's the next set of equations to do.
Yes, I mean while we as physicists seem to know some things about our universe, there's just a heck of a lot more we don't know. And every equation we have that seems to describe some aspect of reality points to yet some unknown territory, which is why I still have a job.
Well, the mysteries are the mysteries.
That's right.
But it's great to tackle them as much as you can and understand that life is really created from, let's call it asymmetry instead of symmetry, because we try to create symmetry in our life. We try to create balance and harmony and be as tuned in as possible.
Symmetry on the right side. On the right side.
Some announcing going on around you.
So
we're trying to tune in to our harmonies and our symmetries in life.
Yes.
But what about asymmetry? Why is that so important?
Yes, that's a beautiful... I think you've nailed one of the key points. So one of the things I really try to do was to find parallels between some important things that I notice in jazz, and both listening to jazz, playing jazz, or learning how to play jazz, and the underworkings of the physical universe, and this dance between symmetry and asymmetry, the necessity to actually have both, okay, was a common parallel that I found between music, improvisation, and the inner workings of our quantum universe. And let me say a few words about that. So when we look at life itself, we ask, well, what is life? And in fact, one of the great physicists, Erwin Schrödinger, asked this question, what is life? How is it that a rock, which is made up of, the same molecules and atoms that a living entity might be made up of, carbon-based things, but what makes a rock inanimate, not living, versus a living thing? And what Schrödinger basically realized was that at the atomic level, non-living matter, like, for example, a piece of metal, the way that the atoms organized itself was in a very symmetric pattern, whereas living matter, in particular, when we look at DNA, DNA is asymmetric, or as Schrödinger called it, aperiodic. So in other words, in a metal, the atoms will organize themselves in some sort of periodic array, sort of like a checkerboard, right? Whereas in DNA, what you find is that the double helix actually is an aperiodic pattern. And that aperiodicity is less symmetry than a completely periodic system. And so the aperiodicity, that breaking of the symmetry, the fact that symmetry no longer exists, that periodic symmetry no longer exists, actually enables the DNA to actually have an attribute that's necessary for life. Well, what is that attribute? It allows the DNA molecule to be stable. And it's the mechanical stability, right, that allows the DNA to store the genetic code over a lifetime, because it's more stable than something that's symmetric. So you see this functioning happening, the fact that you have, in this case, an asymmetry functioning to give you an attribute necessary for a living thing, which is you need to store the genetic code for that living entity throughout a lifetime, through 100 years.
But I would think that that asymmetry creates uncertainty, and therefore I wouldn't understand stability in that context.
Yes, that's because the symmetry basically and asymmetry could function in different ways. So in this particular case, I talked about it functioned to basically give stability, like, a mechanical stability of this molecule. But in terms of uncertainty, right, and asymmetry, we have to talk about a different application. So let me just say, in general, you have this concept. So one of the things that physicists, we try to do is we try to get to the root of to understand something. We try to say, well, what is a simple idea that could be applied to many different things, right? So as you pointed out, could symmetry and asymmetry be applied to a different system now? So in one case, I applied symmetry and asymmetry to a molecule, right? And now we can apply to a different system. So now the system you're asking is, are there things where symmetry and asymmetry could function in a way where you have certainty versus uncertainty? And the answer is yes, okay? And in that case, if you think about, if you think of in music, for example, you can imagine having, you know, a symmetry of notes. So, for example, I can say, if I actually played exactly the same note, right? Let's say in the note C, and the pianist just plays C all the time, right?
Yep.
That's going to be a very uninteresting song. It's going to be the same note, right? And so there's a symmetry. What's the symmetry? Well, the symmetry is that if I repeat the same note, right, that's the symmetry in the system.
That's like a rock.
Yeah, it's right. It's the system looks exactly the same at every different point in time.
Right.
Right? But so there's a sense of certainty there, right? Because I am to expect exactly the same note at a different point in time. Right? So the symmetry is that I have a straight line, if I think of in terms of musical notation. Right? But
right.
If I'm improvising, and that means that there's an uncertainty about the next note I'm going to play. Right?
Right.
And therefore,
right.
I've broken the symmetry in that system. It's
right.
no longer
but how does
a straight
that
line.
Create stability?
That doesn't... Again, the important thing here, and one of the things I try to get across in the book, is to get the reader thinking like a physicist. And what physicists do, we have a concept, right? And then we apply that concept to different things. And the application will be different. So in this case, there is no notion of stability, right, in music. The fact that I've broken the symmetry, it has nothing to do with stability. In this case, it has to do with uncertainty. But
right.
if I apply it to a mechanical system like a molecule, the role of symmetry and asymmetry is to stabilize or destabilize something. So then I can apply the idea of symmetry and asymmetry to the universe, for example. And then we can say, well, what is the role of symmetry and asymmetry there? And it's going to be a different thing there altogether. But the idea of symmetry and asymmetry, we see, applies to different things. So, for example, I don't want to get into too many details here because there's almost 300 pages in the book where I talk about many other examples where this idea of symmetry and asymmetry does that. But in music, actually, let's say one more example. So there are certain scales that we have in a musical system. And this is something that John Coltrane played with, by the way. So there are scales that if you actually draw on a circle, there's this idea that you can represent notes in a circle. Like, so if I go from C to high C, I can represent all the notes like as a circle. Each point corresponds to a circle, like the time on a clock. You have 12 notes, and each of those notes can look like, you know, a face of a clock. Thing
okay.
has a symmetry, and I can imagine connecting the dots, right? And I do this in the book, by the way. And I hope I can do justice to this show right now. But anyway, you can draw very symmetric objects like a triangle, and that will correspond to a scale. And those scales are used in music. They're called symmetric scales. And it turns out if you actually break the symmetry, so if you go from a perfect triangle to something that's like not a perfect triangle, that creates a sense of musical stability. In this case, it will create a harmonic stability. So you can go from dissonance to consonance, from going from a symmetric situation to an asymmetric situation. So the idea here is that in music, breaking symmetry or having asymmetry creates a sense of musical stability. And you can actually hear this, right? In You Are the Sun of My Life, Stevie Wonder, right? You can actually hear that. And I describe that in the book. So that's a little teaser.
Like that's what music is. It's like the truth of breaking the stability of it, or the
that's
symmetry
right.
of it. Now,
that's one way to think about it, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what I want to look at is the idea of entropy and what makes things move forward in life. What is evolution? How did the universe grow? And it had to grow in ways that produced all of the galaxies and planets and us, and it had to grow in a way that wasn't entropy. that somehow it grew rather than collapsed on itself or canceled itself. And so there had to be some dissonance in order to do that, but it also had to include some resonance in order to make sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
So I guess a lot of your formulations are on finding resonance to understand how things fit together, right?
Yes. So just to recap the history of the universe, we know from data the universe has been expanded from a very hot, dense, much smaller universe 30 to 14 billion years ago. And that universe was, in a sense, very, it was, in a sense, a very simple universe. It had no galaxies, no stars, no structure, right? No asymmetry.
Right.
No asymmetry.
Right.
So it was a very symmetric situation in the past.
Right, too symmetric.
too symmetric to be interesting, just like those notes. Like,
right.
Just like the same, playing exactly the same note. It's not too interesting, it's very symmetric. And what happened, the energy in the universe, right? You can think of the early universe as like a sea of energy, just like radiation energy that is undergoing undulations, but this undulation is quite chaotic and it has no rhyme or reason. But what's
right.
Very interesting that I discussed is that the energy is sound energy. So, it's literally, the universe is functioning like an instrument. It's playing sound, okay? It's actually creating sound in this radiation. And what we know is that you have a resonance, meaning that a lot of energy in that sound is going into a small set of frequencies, just like when you play a piano and you strike one note, right? A lot of the energy is going into creating that one frequency. Likewise, in early universe, you had this, you have a lot of dissonance, but you do also have consonance, right? And that sound energy is the thing that breaks the symmetry, in a sense.
It's an evolution that strives through finding a resonance that makes sense, that can actually create matter that makes sense and create life.
Yes, in the sense of making sense, in this sense, means to create the first stars and galaxies, which later on, are responsible for set, having the right conditions for life.
Right, and so
but,
people
but
who are religious might think that God is behind the correct resonances. But what I really
we still don't know what set up those, what really set up those we have theories about that, but none of those theories have yet to be confirmed.
Exactly. Now, what I like is your understanding and what you found out about D-brains, B-R-A-N-E, like a membrane.
Yes.
This isn't a membrane. It's a dimensional brain, and
yes.
That's why you call it a D-brain. And that has a lot to do with creating life itself because it's multidimensional.
Yes, so that's right. One of the things that I was one of the original developers of was to use ideas in string theory to say things about the early universe. And the string theory is a candidate theory that unifies all the forces of nature. So it's a good theoretical framework to start asking questions that we could ordinarily can't answer about the early universe. And D-brains are objects, higher dimensional objects, that exist naturally in string theory. And that's correct.
Right. And from what I understand, if we go back to the primordial plasma that existed,
yes.
There had to be something that inspired it to create the universe. And it had to come from somewhere. There had to be some asymmetry in this pure energy that created what some people call the Big Bang, which was a huge inflation, a huge expansion that had to start from somewhere. and one supposition is the D-brains that are multidimensional could exist from perhaps other universes and come into this plasma and instigate change.
That's a nice summary of very poetic.
Thank you. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, good. All right. So, so what I like also is that you also talk about a cyclic universe, a rhythmic universe that is expanding and eventually contracts to back to its pure state again, and then expands again. And it could have been, we might have had thousands or millions of these universes before, and we'll have after. We don't know.
Yes.
Even though this universe is billions of years old, it could be one of billions of universes time and again and again. And the only reason we think it's a long time is that we're here measuring it. Right? Otherwise, it just keeps creating itself.
Eternal recurrence. It's the same universe.
Your line is breaking up a little bit.
Yeah. All right. Let me know when you can hear me. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now, yes.
Okay, I'll just repeat it. We're being recorded, right? So you'll be able to.
Yes.
You'll be able to. Okay, good.
I just lost you again. Hello?
Okay. Okay, let me know when you're ready.
Okay, yeah, let's start. Good.
Okay.
So, go ahead.
Let me just finish a thought here. So, I would like to think of our universe, the cyclic universe, as basically one that we're living in the same universe. It's just very old, and it's gone through basically cycles of being created and destroyed. And what's very interesting is the ancient Hindus, this was their idea, and it seems that a lot of modern physics seems to be pointing that our universe might actually be cyclic. I mean, eternal. It never had a beginning. It never had an end. It just underwent what appeared to be little beginnings and little ends.
Right. Good. I like that, too. I like both ways, that it's rhythmic or just keeps going.
Just keep going.
Yeah. So let's hope we can, too. So what's exciting is that you, as a jazz musician, you really understand that life is really about the and I love the word resonance, that you create new resonances in your improvisation that is, as artistic, it's moving. It moves our experience of jazz by having these riffs that really create beauty. And and that's
a metaphor
life
for life
is about. Right.
It's a metaphor for life, and also it's a metaphor for being a scientist, actually, because many people think that being a scientist, including myself, as I was a student of science, had the wrong idea, and you know, the media has not done such a great job at portraying it this way, that scientists are these, you know, very rote, logical people out of touch with reality. Well, some of us are, but some of the great scientists were not. And you know, a lot of good science comes out of irrational thinking, comes out of intuitive thinking, comes out of sometimes making the wrong turn, making mistakes and embracing mistakes. And that, you know, that seems to look a little bit like how jazz musicians also play.
Yeah, and you had a mentor one time who told you to stop reading physics books.
Yeah, this is one of the greatest mathematical physicists alive, Chris Isham, that told me that. And so, you know, that I have to take that very seriously.
Right, and that says so much about how we have to take life too. Is we have to stop, you know, let's say, trying to create so much structure and live more in improvisation, live more in the magic of life unfolding intuitively, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's amazing. That, you know, thanks for saying that. And because sometimes, you know, life doesn't throw what we interpret to be good things at us. So, like, you know, this improvisation, living an improvisational life or doing science in a more improvisational way, yeah, sometimes you have to, you know, as we say in Trinidad, that's where I'm from originally, we have to suck salt. You don't like how it tastes. But, you know, it comes with it. It's that dance between consonants and dissonance, you know.
Right.
If it's too consonant, it's not interesting. If it's too dissonant, that's also not interesting. But that sort of that dance between, you know, between that. I just want to say one thing quickly. I noticed that a lot of people mistook my book. They thought my book, I was trying to say the universe is a jazz, you know, song, or there's some like, people are looking for things that I wasn't intending to really get across. I mean, all I was simply trying to do but draw really interesting parallels between jazz music, and the inner workings of our universe, but by no way trying to make any definitive, like, claims about, you know, some crazy connection between those two things. And I think it's important to keep things open that way, yeah.
It comes up in so many ways. For instance, the idea that the universe was created by sound is,
yes.
You know, there is a sound in everything. You know, everything has sound, and it has vibration. It has all kinds of energies to it that you can compare jazz to. But I think the biggest part of it was understanding the principles of structure and harmony and symmetry and instability.
That's right. And you know, behind Einstein's, this is very interesting, right? It, you know, 2,500 years of human thought that basically culminated with Albert Einstein's great discovery of theory of relativity. And what's really interesting, I don't know if I really got this point home in the book, so let me say it here, is that what underlies, I mean, the thinking that really led the key kernel of thought that led to the discovery of relativity is symmetry. And what was really interesting was that idea informed all of the other physicists after Einstein to then figure out the other three forces of nature using similar symmetry principles. And it's
right.
Kind of cool that this also underlies a lot of Western music as well. And I want to claim non-Western music as well, too.
Unless you know the structure, you can't know the non-structure.
Well said.
Thank you. So we're getting to the end of the show. I don't know how much time we really have left because we had a few interruptions. But this is wonderful to talk about this with you, Stefan Alexander.
Thank you. You're very insightful. You know, you're making me actually rethink maybe my book is actually making a little bit, of a case between a deep connection between jazz and the universe.
Oh, thank you so much. So the name of your book is The Jazz of Physics. Where can people go on the web?
Yeah, I know it's on Amazon. It's in Barnes & Noble. And you can, there's a Kindle. There's also an audio by Audible version you can get. I got mine on Amazon. I actually had to buy my own book.
That's interesting.
Well, I gave away all my author copies. So.
Well, it's wonderful. Everybody should be grabbing copies. The Jazz of Physics. I just so love reading this and talking with you. Stefan Alexander, thanks so much for being on Energy Stew.
Hey, thanks for having me. And it's a real honor to be on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.